been funny, he said. She's not as bright. She's not bright like you. She's bright in a totally different way. How can she be bright in a different way, she said. What is her area of expertise? Is she bright about cooking? Literature? She knows languages? Oh, Jesus, he said. Really, it's just so interesting to me, she said, that you thought I would want to hear that this beautiful girl is also brilliantly smart and you love her. I don't love her, he said. I don't know why we're having this conversation. I'm jealous, okay, she said. I admit, I'm jealous. Look, we don't have a commitment, but we certainly have an area of commitment, which is that we talk to each other. I mean, we don't understand each other, but we don't pretend to understand each other like other people do, and I feel betrayed here. I suppose you talk to her like you talk to me. Look, he said, I don't think we should continue this discussion. I don't like this side of you. I'm not a box, she said. I don't have sides. This is it. One side fits all. This is it. How did we get into this, he said? Do we need to have this fight? We have an understanding that we don't have an understanding, and we enjoy it very much. Now, I think we should just order some food and have a pleasant evening, if that's possible. All right, yeah, she said. I let myself in for it. I should never have asked you. Eddie Samuel said the other day that you sounded just like me in a meeting, she said. Well, we spend a lot of time on the phone, he said, but I doubt if I sound just like you. We sound like each other a little bit. We talk a lot. I mean, Eddie Samuels is a putz, okay? That's why he's a production secretary. Hey, my shrink said a great thing this week. Norma, the insight queen, he said. She said you were my fantasy playmate, she said. Really, he said. Sounds like a Playboy title or something. What else does your shrink say? She calls us the mindfuck twins, she said. She said I'm feasting on a banquet of crumbs. Sounds like she should be writing scripts, he said. You really think you're going to a good shrink? Those don't sound like such enormous insights. I mean, forgive the pun, but I don't think I'm so crummy to you. I think we have a very modern relationship. I think it's a reaction to the times. You know, we have no real rules and we're both very independent, but certainly we kind of respect each other. In a certain way, I admire you. Thank you, she said. I admire you, too. I love your work and your eyes. No, I think she was just saying she actually doesn't like the idea of me seeing you. She thinks it's not good for me. She thinks I sort of use you because I would have a lot of difficulty having another kind of relationship. What's wrong with this relationship, he said. I mean, it's not a relationship, but what's wrong with this? We both have similar feelings. We feel cut off from the other people. We share a certain disdain for the Hollywood lifestyle we love. And I think we have a camaraderie that's very... Oh, come on, she said. We have a camaraderie, but this is a kind of a weird thing we're doing. I mean, it's weird. We have an oddness. Well, what does your therapist think? I don't let my therapist run my life, he said. You know, I go in, I talk to him, I think of him as a good bounce. Mainly, I go to hear myself think, and sometimes I'll discover something through what I say. I've been seeing him for a lot of years, and we did most of the main thrust of the work on my early family stuff in the beginning. Now it's just, well, it's like going in for a brush-up, like teeth cleaning. Anyway, you're probably not describing this accurately to your shrink, or she wouldn't object to it. I mean, she doesn't know me, so she's not basing her objections on an experience of me, but on something you're telling her. And I think you must have misrepresented this situation, because I don't think there's that much wrong with it. Remember the line from Philadelphia Story, she said? To hardly know him is to know him well. I feel like that's us, like we'll just go on and on and on like this, but we'll never quite get past the incandescence of that first meeting. There's this sort of dull phosphorusness we maintain now, but, I mean, on a certain level, you're the closest thing to love I have in my life right now, but it's still very far away. The closest thing I have to a relationship is very far away. I think that's interesting. I'd like to meet someone like you, he said, but there's no one more like you than you. Maybe we can get somebody to introduce us, she said. Dreaming outside your head. Suzanne was desperate for something she felt would legitimize her, or that would be perceived as legitimizing her, something that would cause her to seem desirable. Ideally, she would accept the marriage proposal of a member of the royal family who would renounce his throne for her. Since this was hardly likely, she concentrated on an alternate plan, getting work. Her agents finally got her an offer for a low-budget film called The Kitchen Sink. The Kitchen Sink was a mistaken identity comedy about a pair of undercover cops, Robert Munch and Suzanne, who endure a series of mishaps while investigating a prostitute ring and end up in jail and then get married. Since the film was shooting just outside of Palm Springs, Suzanne decided to stay with her grandparents, who lived in a two-bedroom house in the desert. The house had a flag in the front and a pool in the back, both of which lent it a kind of protection. A strange bracket. Her grandfather, whom she adored, had gotten pretty senile. Suzanne was never sure if he quite knew who she was, but whoever she was always glad to see her. He spent most of his time sleeping or watching Mexican TV, though he spoke almost no Spanish. Her grandmother, though, was as right there as she could be without making people wish she was somewhere else. She had three Yorkies, Jigger, Peanut, and Howdy. And when she wasn't doing her mosaics or microwaving Franco-American food, she was talking to her dogs. "Didn't she, Jigger?" she would croon. "Wouldn't I, Peanut? Isn't that right, Howdy?" On the morning of her first day of shooting, Suzanne's alarm rang at 5. She went into the bathroom and, without turning on the light, started her bath. Then she climbed back into bed for a brief reprieve, trying to be grateful she was finally working again. She lay there, half awake, thinking about the wrap party of her first movie. She had hugged her dresser, Rosie, a 45-year-old woman with a thick Cockney accent, and said, "I'll miss you so much. Give me your address and phone number." Rosie had replied, "Love, what's more unlikely is we'll never see each other again." 10 years had passed since then, and so far Rosie was right. It was always like that, Suzanne thought as she stepped into her bath. You did a film for a few months, and you got a family. An intimate family with its own dynamic, its own in-jokes, its own likes, dislikes, and romances. The intensity of it was heightened by the knowledge that it was all temporary. Not only did you know that it would end, but give or take a week or two, you knew when. What you didn't know was how the whole thing would turn out. It could be good entertainment, it could be bad. It could succeed, it could fail. He was mining for celluloid gold. Suzanne dressed quickly, not bothering to dry her hair, and crept out of the dark house, past the dogs, the microwave, and the stars and stripes, and into the station wagon that waited in the driveway to take her to work. They arrived at the set at 5:30, just as the sun was coming up over the Joshua trees. Suzanne watched the frantic activity of the set against the otherwise serene backdrop of the desert. It was as if this movie set was some inane act of nature. "And the Lord said, let there be entertainment," thought Suzanne as she got out of the car. Then, remembering the script, she added, "Of sorts." Show business, Suzanne thought. It's only about distraction, a way of being transported out of your life, of having someone else's life for a while. Identifying with them, feeling relief that their predicament isn't yours, or feeling relief that it is. A way of dreaming outside your head. "I brought you clothes," said Rita, a voluptuous woman verging on heavy with the kindest, watery blue eyes Suzanne had ever seen on a movie set. "We should get them on you." Suzanne saw that the wardrobe mistress also had dimples and freckles, all the friendly features. Rita helped Suzanne get into her outfit, which consisted of jeans, a sweatshirt, and sneakers. Just as she was tying her last sneaker, the assistant director, Ted, came in brandishing a Diet Coke. "Your caffeine ration," he said, handing Suzanne the cold can. "Thanks," she said. "Where can I get more of these, should the need arise?" "Prop truck," said Ted. "Ask Raider, the prop guy, or I can get you one if you're nice to me." "Oh, I'm nice," she said. "I think these will be remembered as my nice years, quickly to be followed by the sullen months and then, of course, the obscure decades. I only recently finished those wacky fuck-up years, so you're the first to benefit from my reform." Joe Pierce walked into the trailer. The line producer was a nondescript man wearing a white polo shirt and jeans that on him looked like slacks. He looked like somebody's stepfather. "Any more people in here," he said, "and we'd need a lubricant." Suzanne laughed uneasily, and Rita excused herself. "See you later, Rita," Joe called jovially, then fixed what passed for his attention on Suzanne. "I just came by to say hello and make sure everything was up to snuff," he said. "Everything's great," Suzanne assured him, forcing a smile. "I want you to know we really appreciate your doing a drug screen," said Joe, who with his tiny dark eyes and his big white head reminded Suzanne of a sand dab. She put her soda can down. "Sure," she said. "Did I pass?" "Did you pass?" Joe echoed, laughing. "Of course you passed. We knew you would. It was the insurance company that was worried, not us. You apparently had some problems on your last film, but..." Joe slapped his knee and stood up. "I just want you to know we're right behind you 100%. Well, I'll leave you to get ready." He opened the door. "See you out there," he said, disappearing with a wave. The director, Simon Markham, was English. A nice guy. She'd met him the night before when they'd interviewed her for the job. For all her desperation, she hadn't cared that much if she got the part or not. She simply assumed she would never work again. Whenever she wasn't working, Suzanne knew she'd never work again, and when inevitably she did work, she knew it was the last time. It was a relationship with her profession that was based on trust. "Oh, good morning, darling," Simon said, almost kissing her on both cheeks. "You're looking well." Suzanne smiled as she rode back to her grandparents' house that evening. It had been a good day, she thought. She'd met at least 5 people who were in AA, including Bobby Munch and his wife, who was down here with him. She'd found someone who would give her some water pills before her bathing suit scene. She'd remembered most of her dialogue, and Simon had seemed pleased with her work. She'd met the 2 executive producers toward the end of the day, and even though they'd been nicer to Bobby than to her, she chalked it up to the overall sexism prevailing in show business and let it go at that. Suzanne felt that her acceptance of her reality verged on the adult and was almost proud of herself. Yes, all in all, a pretty good first day. The next morning, while the cameras were being repositioned for close-ups, Simon came over and sat down next to Suzanne. He was friendly, but there was something else. He seemed almost embarrassed. "What's happening?" said Suzanne cheerfully. "Did you have to take a drug test, too?" Simon looked confused. "Oh, no, he said. It's nothing, really. They just... The producers saw rushes last night and had some rather interesting notes." Suzanne instantly tensed up. She began wringing out her hair, which had been soaked for the chase in the rain sequence they were filming. "Well, what?" she said as calmly as she could manage it. "Now, don't take it the wrong way," Simon said. "I saw them this morning and you were fine." "It was my first day," Suzanne said, staring at the ground. "It was your first day, absolutely," he said emphatically. "I couldn't agree with you more. The producers simply felt you should have fun with it." He stopped and smiled at her. "Just..." He shrugged. "Have more fun with it, that's all." Suzanne stared at him. "Simon, if I knew how to have fun with stuff, I wouldn't be in therapy. I wouldn't need to have drug tests." Now, Simon said, tilting his head and looking at her as if she wouldn't finish her vegetables. "I think they had some very interesting comments. Maybe I'm not saying it properly. What I think they mean is that you could just own your own performance. Make it more your own. Just sort of... have fun." Suzanne stared at an anthill at her feet. "Really?" she said sarcastically to the ants. "And here I thought everything I did had to be fraught with torment. This is incredible. Why didn't one of my shrinks tell me this?" "Now, Suzanne," Simon said patiently, "you shouldn't be in this business if you can't take criticism." It was true that Suzanne couldn't take criticism. Even when directors gave her direction, she often took it as criticism. "But, Simon, please," she said, not looking at him, "have fun with it. I mean, don't you think I would do that with everything I did if it was at all possible?" Simon put his arm around her. "I know you can do this part. Just relax into it. Be yourself and you'll be wonderful." He kissed the top of her head and went off to talk to his DP as Ted walked up to her with a can of Diet Coke. "Nutrasweets for the sweet," he said, handing it to her. "You know what I think," she said. "Actors are the lowest of the low. Unless they have box office, in which case they're treated with respect without being respected." She took a swig of soda. "At least with me there's an honest level of contempt. They don't respect me and they don't treat me with respect." Taking her arm, Ted said, "We need to get you touched up. You're in the next shot." After the scene, Suzanne went over to the prop truck to check on the cookie and candy possibilities. She was humming, "There's no business like show business," as she arrived at the truck. She almost collided with Neil Bleen, the younger of the executive producers. "I understand my enjoyment levels are down." Neil looked down at his crocodile shoes and cleared his throat. "Well, no," he began in an amused tone. "We felt the performance was fine, but..." He scanned the horizon for the right phrase. "You're holding something back." Suzanne realized that she was older than Neil Bleen, who couldn't be much more than 26. "Holding something back," she repeated solemnly. "It felt like you weren't... that you didn't really make a choice. You made a non-choice. Like you were concentrating more on not doing something than on doing something." "I see," Suzanne said. "I've acted in theater," Neil explained. "I've also directed theater. I'm doing this to make money, but basically I'm a theater director. From what I was told, you spontaneously hit Bobby during a rehearsal and Simon stopped you. Well, I don't think that he should stop your impulses." Neil was really wailing now. The other thing is that sometimes certain line readings are appropriate. Like in comedy, it's a rule that inflections go up at the end. Suzanne knelt down to look in his eyes without giving up the separation and protection of the truck. "There's a comedy rule?" she asked. Neil ran his hands through his hair. "Well, there's not necessarily rules so much as guidelines, comedy guidelines." He paused for a moment, then came at her from another angle. "You were very good in public domain. What did you do there?" he asked patiently. "I had Magna Valnapov as my acting coach and Benjamin Keller as my director," she almost shouted. "I didn't have fun with it. We had a month of rehearsals. We worked very hard. We hardly ever relaxed." Neil shook his head benignly. "We're talking about 2 minutes of film, 2 minutes of screen time out of 90. "Is it correctable?" she asked. Neil laughed. "Oh, come on," he said reassuringly. "It's not as though you farted during all your dialogue and we all sat in the rushes and said, 'What's that noise?' all over her lines." "I'm so relieved," Suzanne said. "That analogy has bathed me in relief." She jumped off the prop truck, careful not to spill her soda. "Thanks for the acting tips and pep talk," she said over her shoulder as she headed back to the set. "I'm feeling much more relaxed now." She hadn't been back at her grandparents' house for 10 minutes when the phone rang. "Have I caught you at a bad time?" asked George Lazanne. "No, not at all," she said politely. "How are you?" "Well, look," George said. "I saw the rushes, and frankly, you're holding back. See, I think of this piece as a light, fluffy piece, a kind of what's up doc for cops, so you gotta relax. You gotta just enjoy yourself and trust the process." Suzanne watched her grandfather's incredibly long cigarette ash grow while he stared at the ball game on the living room TV. "Well," she said, "I can't really promise you I'm going to turn in a Barbara Streisand performance." "No, no, 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 no," George said. "You see, I think of Bob Munch as a kind of Ryan O'Neill type. He's a reactive actor. What we need for you is to be the one who governs the pace of the piece. If you dictate the pace, then Bob will follow you." Suzanne sat down and pulled Jigger into her lap and said nothing. "So we need you to establish the pace, and Bob will follow you," he restated brusquely. Suzanne stroked Jigger. "I hardly think I'm responsible for the pace of the piece." "Well, look," said George impatiently, "it's a happened one night kind of thing. You know what I mean." He cleared his throat. "Look, do you think you can do this part?" Suzanne went cold. Jigger jumped out of her lap. The ash fell off her grandfather's cigarette. "Yeah," she said in a small voice. "Why?" "This is surreal," she thought. "I'm going to be fired from a bad movie for not relaxing."
"I always ask my actors that," he explained. "Look, just because we imagined Goldie Hawn or a Marilyn Monroe kind of thing in this part, now we've got to deal with what you have to bring to it. We hired you, now we've got to go with what you have."
Suzanne sighed. "This is a lot," she thought. "This is as hard as I was hit for taking drugs."
"I appreciate your comments, Mr. Lazanne," she said finally. "I'll certainly give relaxing my best shot. If I'm not enjoying myself, though, it's not because I'm deliberately trying to sabotage your film." Before she lifted the receiver to dial Norma, the phone rang. "It's me, Rob," her agent.
"Well, George Lazanne called me today, and he's very upset. He says you're not enjoying your work." Suzanne felt what she had been holding together all day quickly begin to come apart. "If George Lazanne is upset about that, he should see a shrink," Suzanne said tightly. "If he's upset about me not enjoying my work, he should fucking go into therapy."
"Don't do this to me," said Suzanne ominously. "Do not do this to me. I don't want to be in this business anymore anyway." She started to cry. "I will not be treated like I'm deliberately withholding something. I went into this thing on Monday and it's Tuesday and I'm doing the best I can. I got the job Friday night. It's Tuesday."
She sniffed loudly and felt silly.
"Well," said Rob, sounding worried, "there's no need to get so upset. I simply wanted to pass on what Lazanne said to me."
"Are they going
to
fire me?"
Suzanne demanded.
"No, of course not," he assured her. "What is this, then? This is not going to achieve what they want. This is going to make me defensive. If they want me to relax and enjoy myself, this is not the way to get me to do it. I've been in this business for 12 years, and they're treating me like I just got out of drama school."
"All right, sweetheart. Take it easy." "Honey, you shouldn't get so worked up," her grandmother said from the doorway. "They're treating me like I'm a jerk," Suzanne said.
"Just because they treat you like a jerk doesn't mean you have to act like one. How they treat you is not necessarily who you are. My mother always told me that. She'd say, 'Honey,
Just because they treat you like shit, you could still act like pie.
This was a big reoccurring theme with Great-Grandma Pearl, said Suzanne. I remember her saying that a fly is as likely to land on shit as on pie. So she thought everything could be divided into two categories, either shit or pie.
Well, yeah, but she was a smart woman, very smart woman. But I guess we were never rich enough to have your problems. Not so much time to get ourselves so worked up. Your grandpa worked on the railroad.
She paused for a moment and sat down next to Suzanne on the bed. You know what you should do? You should do something with your writing, with those poems you used to write. Some of your poems are better than anything I've ever read in those cards over at the Palm Desert Mall. Why don't you find out how you can get into that?
I don't know if I want to, Suzanne said dubiously.
Well, then, why don't you find a nice guy and marry him and settle down?
It's the nice part I have trouble with, Suzanne said. Don't you think that if it was going to happen, it would happen already?
Nope, said her grandmother. You're a good age for it. Find a nice guy to take care of you.
Yeah, but, Gran, I'm a lot to take care of.
Oh, you talk big, her grandmother said. You talk big and you think fancy, but you're just like other people. You act all rough and tough, but you're a pushover. You just think too much and you talk too loud.
Don't you think my life is weird, Gran?
Weird, weird, you call everything weird. It's not so weird, but you got to do something sooner or later to get your life together, girl. You don't take those drugs anymore, and I'm real proud of you for that, but now that you can see it clearly, you got to figure out what you want to do with it all.
She was calmer when she arrived on the set the next morning. The first scene was being shot in a car, which was placed on a platform with the crew and all the equipment on it, all of which would be dragged along by a pickup truck. Rita had just finished connecting Suzanne's body mic when Simon walked by with Rocky, the first AD, who was explaining how many extras they needed to do drive-bys in the car scene. Suzanne followed behind them until Simon and Rocky were through. Then she said, "Excuse me, Simon, could I talk to you?"
"Certainly, love," he said. "What's the problem?"
"The problem," she said sternly, "is that four people, including my agent, had conversations with me yesterday concerning my low enjoyment level, and it bothered me. I would prefer to receive directions solely from you." Simon looked concerned, and the wind almost blew off his hat.
"Really," he said in an affronted English tone, "that shouldn't be. I'll have to have a word with him. Your agent called you about this?"
"My agent," Suzanne repeated indignantly, "as if I were a child, as if I were difficult to communicate with," she said, rising to some inner occasion.
"I mean, why don't I give them my mother's number, or better yet, call my grandmother? She's down here. She can stand by and make sure I'm relaxed."
"That's it," Simon said excitedly, snapping his fingers.
"This is her. This is the quality I want for your character, right there. What you're doing now, see?"
But Simon, Suzanne said, trying now not to give him the quality he wanted in her character. "This is not relaxed. This is incredibly upset. If this is the quality, then maybe..."
"Darling," he soothed her, putting his arm around her and walking her toward the car on the platform where the crew was waiting to do a rehearsal. "Just be yourself and you'll be fine. I know it sounds trite, but trust me. I'll talk to the producers and make sure that what occurred yesterday is not repeated. Now try to calm down."
He kissed the top of her head. A week later, on her 30th birthday, Suzanne sat in an unmarked police car, soaked to the skin and waiting for Simon to call action. She looked over at Bobby.
"If this is any indication of how my 30s are going to go," she began.
"Your 30s?" he shouted. "Let's talk about my 40s for a few minutes, shall we? Let's discuss that I have a wife and two daughters, and I'm still soaked to the skin with a big movie wound on my arm playing cops and robbers. What about that I'm 30 and I don't have any children?" countered Suzanne. "Or a husband, for that matter."
Bobby started laughing.
"This is a perfect actor conversation," he said.
"What about me? Oh, yeah? Well, what about me?"
"An actress on her 30th birthday, obsessed about herself," Suzanne said, also laughing.
"I've become typical."
"Sweetheart, you became typical long ago, only you were too stoned to notice."
"Oh, thank you," she said. "I suppose you're not typical."
"Do you think you'll stay in show business till the end of this picture?" he asked.
"Do you mean this show business or the glamorous, fun show business?" Suzanne asked.
"This show business." Suzanne looked around and saw that the entire crew was mooning her and singing happy birthday. Marilyn stood at the car holding a chocolate cake with 31 candles.
"It'll be hard to forget this," said Suzanne, blushing like a desert rose.
"Still," Bobby said, "maybe with enough therapy."
"There isn't enough therapy," says Suzanne.
Dysphoria. The phone rang, jarring Suzanne from her dream. She lurched across her bed. "Hello," she gasped, clearing her sleep-filled throat.
"Hello,"
she repeated, hearing the overseas hiss. "Hello," she heard a male voice cry from deep inside the phone. "Is Suzanne Vail there, please?"
"Who's calling?" Suzanne asked, with her eyes shut tight to block out the morning sun experience.
"Sven Gehuden," the accented voice carefully said. "I met her at an Est intensive several years ago, and she told me to call her if I should ever..."
"Suzanne is on a verbal fast retreat in New Mexico," interrupted Suzanne.
"The Inside Chaparral?" cried Sven.
"I think that's the one," said Suzanne patiently.
"Well, tell her I just wanted to share with her about a breakthrough I had watching a film of hers here in Stockholm," Sven said.
"I'll tell her," said Suzanne in her best let's wind this up voice.
"And that I've quit medical school to work full-time on the Hunger Project," Sven finished.
"Okay, I'll tell her," said Suzanne with some gusto. "Goodbye, Sven."
"Who is this?" asked Sven politely.
"A friend of Suzanne's, Ruth Buzzy," said Suzanne.
"Well, thank you very much, Ruth."
"Thank you, Sven. Goodbye." Suzanne replaced the receiver and shook her head. "Ruth Buzzy," she thought with disbelief. "Maybe I should go on a verbal fast."
The storm of sleep had blown her nightgown around her body in such a way that it was cutting off circulation in her left arm. She threw off her blanket as though it were a magic cloak and stood up, preparing to enter the dangerous arena of her day without its much-needed protection. She untwisted her nightgown, walked into the bathroom, ran some water, and moved into the kitchen for some eye-opening orange juice. Suzanne went back to her bedroom and put a cassette in her stereo. She liked to listen to soundtracks in the morning. In the car, she only liked rock and roll, but soundtracks were house music. This morning she put on Somewhere in Time, which sounded like what she thought love was like. It sounded like longing. She listened to the music thoughtfully as she sipped her juice and walked back to the bathroom. Her thoughts seemed more like poetry to her and less like idle chatter with this music on. She turned off the water and sat in the tub. The score started to gnaw at Suzanne a little as she bathed. It had been recommended to her by a musician she had gone out with once named Chester Price, whom she had liked but had never heard from again. She couldn't remember whether she had liked him before she had never heard from him again or afterward. In any case, he had told her about this music. He said he listened to it a lot. But he hadn't warned her that it sounded like feelings you had to be brave about. Suzanne imagined Chester listening to it in his car as he wistfully drove over a cliff. She reached for her towel, stood up, and got out of the tub, surveying her reflection in the mirror. She had to get thin. In fact, she had to get too thin, so she could eat for a couple of days and not have to worry about it that much. "I won't eat today unless I absolutely have to," she thought. Then she saw the looming largeness of a new blemish on her chin. She was especially dismayed because she had to go to her friend Wallace's party that night, which would have been difficult enough for her to attend with a relatively clear skin. She got into her gym outfit, which was a black bathing suit with little teddy bears on it that she had purchased in Hawaii a few years ago after losing her luggage. She pulled on her turquoise and black check shorts, black socks, turquoise sneakers, sprayed herself with perfume and deodorant, wiped some makeup under her eyes, got her purse, put on her sunglasses, and left for the gym. With the sunroof open, the windows down, and the radio up full blast, Suzanne felt at peace. She had once decided that God was in her car stereo and he would play her songs she liked when he was happiest with her. The week before, when God was evidently not happy with her, she had blown out her amplifier playing a Pretenders tape. The speakers had gone dead after she went over a speed bump during middle of the road, and she'd driven around after that in a daze of silence. She'd had it repaired the next day, and now the music, Bob Seger's Still the Same, as she headed west on Olympic, was so loud it made her legs vibrate. She was already a little sad when she turned onto Lincoln Boulevard because it meant she had only one complete song left before she got to Gold's Gym. She liked going to the gym, or rather, she liked having been to the gym, and the only way to have been was to go. She liked that little blip that she got between her shoulder and her tricep from lifting weights. Still, she knew that no matter how much work you did, the only way to get your body to look really great was to eat right. Suzanne only knew how to eat wrong. She got to Gold's Gym 15 minutes late and saw her trainer, Michelle, waiting in front. Michelle was a muscular blonde girl from back east who had been a PCP junkie and who now used the gym to give her what drugs had. "Sorry," said Suzanne. Michelle shrugged. Suzanne was always 15 minutes late. "What are we doing today, legs?" Michelle asked. Suzanne's face went into a fist. Legs were the hardest. "Chest and shoulders," she pleaded wanly.
Okay, Michelle laughed, but you can't avoid those puppies forever. We'll do legs tomorrow. Suzanne was relieved. She had a day's reprieve. She looked around as she followed Michelle back to the machines, recognizing some of the regulars. The tall guy with the headband and the Egyptian hieroglyphics on his arm. The wiry, dark-haired actor who was always drenched with sweat. And her favorite, the giant black guy who was there all day, every day, and never spoke to anyone. From the way he acted, Michelle guessed that he'd served a lot of time. "There's your boyfriend," she said under her breath. "I love him," Suzanne said moonily as Michelle positioned her correctly on the shoulder machine. "He's so great," she said, beginning to struggle with the weights. "He never talks. He's the epitome of mystery, the paint-by-numbers guy. You can totally fill him in." She was forced to stop talking as the exercise became more difficult. "I wish I found him interesting," sighed Michelle. "I wish I found anyone that interesting. I'm on E."
"On what?"
gasped Suzanne. "E," repeated Michelle. "Empty. Nothing motivates me. I haven't had a good crush in weeks. Do five more. 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. More!"
"It's too heavy,"
Suzanne moaned.
"It's only 30 pounds, Michelle exclaimed.
She let Suzanne rest for a few minutes between sets, then led her to the next machine. Suzanne got quieter as she got farther into the exercises. She did a last set in silence, trying to concentrate on something high on the wall so she didn't have to look at herself in the mirror. She had done 8 repetitions when she started to give up.
"Go!" cried Michelle. "You're almost there!"
"No!" screamed Suzanne, embarrassing herself and finishing anyway, then letting the weights fall with a clunk. She did several unenthusiastic sets of abs, after which Michelle walked her to her car. At the door, they met Chad Paley, the Rams linebacker. "Hey, sunshine," he greeted Suzanne. "Chad," she said, "I bet you know. Who is that big black guy over there on the shoulder machine?" He stared into the gym in the direction she had pointed, and his face darkened. "Keep away from him," he said, glowering. "He's bad news."
"Why?" asked Michelle. "What did he—"
"He served time for manslaughter, for one thing," Chad said. "And for another thing, he's gay. You can see him most nights on Hollywood Boulevard."
"Oh," said Suzanne meekly.
"You stay away from him," warned Chad paternally. He chucked Suzanne under the chin and strode back to the life cycles. The girls walked out without looking back at the silent man pumping iron for Hollywood Boulevard.
"Stay away from him," Suzanne said. "What was I going to do, date him?"
They walked up to Suzanne's BMW. "Tomorrow," she said confidently, "legs." Michelle nodded. "And stick to your diet," she said.
"I will," said Suzanne, turning off the alarm and getting into the car.
"You will not," Michelle said.
"Probably a little of both," said Suzanne, starting her engine.
"I will and will not. The Zen diet."
"And you'll end up looking like a Buddha," shouted Michelle over Don Henley's "All She Wants to Do Is Dance" on the radio as Suzanne waved and drove off.
She went home to wash her hair and change clothes for her lunch with Al Hawkins, some manager who wanted to handle her career. Her friend Bob Becker had set up the lunch, and she was not looking forward to it. She put on a little blue dress that was both comfortable and looked halfway decent. It fell exactly between her 2 clothing classifications, dressing for me and dressing for them. It was very hard to find a miracle dress like this, but she had accumulated 3. This one had a little burn hole on the lower left side, but she was pretty sure no one would notice. She applied her makeup, checking on the steady progress of her blemish, and blow-dried her hair. She turned the dryer off 4 times while she was using it because she kept thinking she heard the phone ringing, but it never was. Then she put on some black high heels, which she felt firmly planted her outfit in the dressing for them category, and left for the restaurant she had selected, the Hamburger Hamlet on Beverly Drive. About a block from the Hamlet, she found herself driving behind an enormous Bentley, the driver of which appeared to be on the phone. Staring at the back of the barbered head, Suzanne suddenly knew, with absolute certainty, that he was her lunch date. She tried to keep alive the possibility that she was wrong, but when he signaled his turn into the parking lot, she was overcome with dread. Could she drive around the corner to the Safeway and call the restaurant and tell Al Hawkins she was sick? She'd already canceled and rescheduled this lunch 3 times. She had to go. "Oh, well, maybe I'll learn something," she thought philosophically as she handed her keys to the valet. She imagined herself smoking serenely on a pipe and gazing off to sea and saying, "Well, yeah, sure, he was an asshole, but
He wasn't your typical asshole. I really learned something that day at the Hamlet.
The instant she walked into the restaurant, she heard a loud New York voice bark, Suzanne? Sure enough, it was the skipper of the SS Bentley.
Al Hawkins, she asked meekly.
The same, bellowed Al, shaking her hand. Why don't we go to the table? Miss, he called to a waitress. Is our table ready? Thanks.
Al Hawkins steered Suzanne to a table against the wall under a mirror. He was under 6 feet with a short, almost military haircut, brown eyes, a deep tan, and very good teeth. His, Suzanne guessed. He was wearing weird sunglasses on top of his head, long black glasses, the kind Ferrari would make if they went into the sunglass business. He was wearing a blue button-down T-shirt and tight, faded blue jeans. He was like a sergeant in the showbiz corps, and Suzanne felt like some lowly private with AWOL leanings. He handed the waitress a couple of singles to get him some cigarettes and steered Suzanne like an invalid to her seat. You sit facing out, okay? Okay, he said. He was completely self-contained. He asked questions and answered them. Suzanne felt superfluous. Suddenly, Al got to the point. What I'd like to say right up front is how much I dislike your choice of agents.
Pardon me?
Suzanne didn't quite know where she was. When Bob gave me your number, I hadn't known you had gotten a new agent, Al said. I couldn't possibly work with Mark Auerbach. I think he's full of shit.
Really?
Said Suzanne without expression. She could just as well have said hunchback or toaster for all the impact it had on Al. He was on a roll now, and she was truly incidental. None of my people are with the Empire Agency, Al was saying. I moved all my people, even Zita Farina. She's going to be a huge star. Suzanne nodded and wondered how much his watch cost as the waitress mercifully arrived with their food. She stuffed a banana into her mouth and made a mental note to kill Bob Becker.
You know what I'd do with you, said Al, salting his fries. Suzanne shook her head, even though Al wasn't looking at her.
I'd put the word out that you were a client of mine and we were interested in projects and see what kind of reaction we'd get. See where you stand. He took a big bite of his hamburger and kept talking as he chewed. You're perfect for a series, because you can play intelligent. People like intelligent. We have a series in development right now that you might be perfect for.
Well, send it to me, Suzanne said, more to her cottage cheese than to him. I'll read it.
I'll send it to you when we have a script, Al said. It's a show for a guy and three women. You'd be great for the younger woman, the magazine editor. Very bright, funny, down to earth.
I'd like to do a series, Suzanne said seriously. I mean, I'd be stupid not to, but I keep thinking that movies are more...
You're being naive, interrupted Al, waving a French fry dismissively. If you can get a good part in a pilot, you should go for it.
Who is this guy? Suzanne wondered.
Whether I'm being naive or not, she said testily, I would like to explore it a little bit before jumping into television world. It's a potentially enormous career maker, Al said, chewing another bite of burger. Remember Happy Days? Henry Winkler got sixth billing. Remember Welcome Back, Cotter? Travolta was way down on the cast list. Tiny speaking part. Suzanne decided she didn't want a personal manager, and she certainly didn't want one that got this personal. People she had known for years didn't call her naive. She felt defeated. She didn't seem to want to be anything badly enough to do what was required. She knew a lot of the right people, but she didn't know them in the right way. Something about pushing your way to the front seemed so undignified. She liked acting, all right. She just didn't like a lot of what you had to do in order to be allowed to act. The readings, the videotapings, the meetings, the criticism, the rejections. She was too old, too young, too pretty, too short, not funny enough, too funny. It could wear you down after a while. After a while, it became a job in itself not to take those pronouncements personally. I'd like to see you do a guest shot on Miami Vice or a Cosby, Al was saying. Do some really good episodic. They could build a whole show around you and then snap. He snapped his fingers. 40 million people see you in one night. But even more important, he said, gesturing with his thumb behind his back, they see you.
Who? Asked Suzanne, looking over his shoulder.
The industry, he answered, exasperated.
Oh, Suzanne said. She felt nauseous. Al continued extolling the virtues of the episodic, and when he paused momentarily, she interjected,
But not that many women go on to movies on TV, except Shelley Long.
You don't count Sally Field, leered Al. The Flying Nun made her.
What about Norma Ray? Asked Suzanne hopefully.
The Flying Nun did it, said Al confidently. It made her.
Suzanne didn't want to argue Norma Ray Flying Nun statistics for the rest of the lunch, so she got up and said with a smile, I'm just going to the men's room.
Quite the kidder, aren't you? Said Al. I like that.
On her way to the bathroom, she passed two women in their late 20s who were standing by the phone and talking about how they could never live in L.A. because the nice weather all the time would annoy them. "I like seasons," one of them said when Suzanne came out. They were still there, talking now about a mutual acquaintance of theirs. "I heard she blew Don Johnson," said the woman who liked seasons. When she got back to the table, Al had paid the bill. "I'm going to keep up with you," he said, rising to greet her. "Okay," said Suzanne, her chest tight. "Good." "I'm going to South Carolina tomorrow to visit a client," he said as they walked to the parking lot. "But I'm going to keep pestering you about my pilot." "Bye, sweetheart," shouted Al. She watched him in her rearview mirror, working on his teeth and adjusting Al Jr., and imagining him nude except for a leather maid's outfit and some nipple clamps. She waved again, then drove into the post-luncheon traffic. By the time she got home, her determination to enjoy her life had been crushed under the weight of the pre-party tension. She opened a Diet Coke, ate a miniature Tootsie Roll, called and left a message for Lucy. She knew she'd be out, but she wanted to go on record as having called, then went in to run her bath. Sometimes when she looked in the mirror, she thought, sure, that girl is attractive. She looks good, but I'm not. She checked her outfit in her full-length mirror. With her tight blue skirt, with her top that snapped between her legs so that it looked tight, and especially with her stockings, she was definitely dressed for them. She stepped into her treacherous black heels, put on her black jacket, grabbed her blue bag, and took one last look at herself. She sighed. "I look like a basketball with lips," she thought. "An angry grape, a two-day-old balloon." "I look ready," she thought, then said aloud, "Let's party," and strode off to her car. She took the long way to Wallace's house so she could have a nice, calming, deafening drive. She found she was now changing stations even when she found a song she liked. She had come to enjoy the quest for a good song more than the songs themselves. Interesting. She checked herself repeatedly in the rearview mirror as she drove. When she was a block away, she saw the parking attendants, dark men in red jackets and black pants. Suzanne saw the cars they'd already parked, the Porsches, the Jaguars, the Rolls's, and suddenly panicked. She got out of her car and turned it over to a total stranger. She thought, I could still leave. I could turn around screaming and sobbing and grab my keys back from the man with the strange sideburns and... She stood in the entrance for a moment, experiencing waves of HPT, Hollywood Party Terror, then went in. Under a large mirror was a silver tray containing tiny envelopes with the names of the guests on them. Suzanne smiled wanly at the butler and headed dutifully for the tray. After some graceful rummaging, she found her envelope. Her name was misspelled. The butler asked if she wanted anything to drink. "Does it show?" she replied, and ordered a stiff Diet Coke. She heard a squeal and spotted Wallace coming toward her, a smiling vision in red and blonde. "If it isn't the brain trust herself," cried Wallace, embracing Suzanne. "You look adorable!" Suzanne knew then with absolute certainty that she must look even worse than she thought. "You mean my huge rubber head?" she mumbled into Wallace's perfect long hair that almost didn't smell of hairspray. Suzanne saw her skin doctor, Walter Marks, enter the room and felt reassured. She made her way over to his beaming, bearded face. "You're disappointed in my hair, aren't you?" she greeted him. "I have too much makeup on, don't I? Be honest with me. Do I look orange?" "You're not drinking, are you?" said Walter. "No, of course not. You don't drink." "You don't drink either, do you?" asked Suzanne, kissing his cheek. "Hardly ever," he said. "I like to feel like I could perform surgery at any given moment." "That's interesting," said Suzanne. "My goal was to feel I could go into surgery at any given moment." "Who are you here with?" Walter asked. "No one. You think I'm desperate, don't you?" "Impaired, yes," Walter said. "Desperate, no. Why do you keep coming to these things when they cause you such torment?" "I don't know," she said, "but I'm working on it in therapy." "How is Norma?" Walter asked. "What a terrific lady." "She's great," Suzanne said. "She said a great thing last week. I told her I thought people confused fame with success, and she said they confused fame with acceptance, and oh, who cares, right?" She found herself sitting to the left of a short, swarthy man she recognized as the Czech director, Gustav Bozina, and to the right of the guest of honor, a businessman named Fred Weaver, whose autobiography was moving up the bestseller list fast enough to have attracted Hollywood's attention. On Fred's left sat Selena Warner, the aging British starlet who played Dorothea Pierce, the red-haired evil head nurse on Chestnut Lodge, a nighttime soap opera set in an insane asylum. Suzanne had been at several parties with Selena Warner. The most recent had been only three nights earlier. Selena's attention had already shifted to Fred Weaver, who asked her something about acting. Suzanne concentrated on avoiding the oysters in her oyster soup. She thought they looked like gray elephant boogers. Horrible food. Fred said something about business, and Selena tilted her head and leaned in knowingly. Her lips moved over her teeth like bubbling water. And when she understood particularly well, she batted her eyelashes at him. Her face was a Richter scale, registering her comprehension. Suzanne now shifted her attention to her right, and, to her dismay, found herself in a conversation about film with Gustav Bozina, whose English was only marginally better than Suzanne's Czech. She tried to ask smart questions, but she thought they just sounded pretentious. Gustav said he liked John Ford, he liked King Vidor, he liked Fellini. I can't believe this, she thought. I'm an asshole at a party talking to a famous director about film. When she heard herself ask, "Do you believe that film is a more visual medium and that things should be described instead of dialogued?" she wanted to cut her head open and drip brains on the table. It was all she could do to keep from choking on her own social vomit. "You do not look so American," Gustav said. "You look European." "Really," Suzanne said, "you're crazed." Gustav said he came from Prague and lived in Paris and that Suzanne didn't look American because she looked right into people's faces. "This Americans do not do," Gustav said. "It is very European." "Really," she said, and kept looking right into his face as if to make sure he didn't go back on what he'd said. She heard herself telling friends, "Gustav Bozina said I was very European." Across the table, a rock promoter named Chris Hunt, who Suzanne thought looked like a losing Senate candidate, he reminded her of John Tunney, was telling a story about Noel Coward going backstage to meet the Beatles. According to the legend, which Suzanne recognized from Noel Coward's memoirs, the Beatles had already left, so Coward went back to their hotel to tell them how much he'd liked the show, and then none of them came out to see him except Paul, who was very awkward. Coward had noted their rudeness in his diary. When he finished the story, the girl next to him, Joan Lilly, a former top British model, declared, "Well, Noel Coward hardly stands the test of time." She said it with total authority, as if she was stating an accepted political position and that anyone who thought otherwise was simply outmoded. "In the final analysis," said Chris Hunt, with the cavalier nonchalance you might overhear wafting out of a car as it drives slowly by, "the Beatles were just more interesting. Noel Coward," he added dismissively, "was a wit."